You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
My name's Madeline Bunting, and I'm a writer. And we're here today to talk about mindfulness. And I'm delighted to be here, and I'm really looking forward to what I hope will be a really interesting conversation. I have to say this is a slightly unusual event for me. Normally when I chair, I'm not personally involved, but I have to say that on this occasion, I am involved. So we will be discussing the work in Parliament of the Mindfulness All-Party Parliamentary Group. And in due course, I'll introduce the guests who are going to talk about that in detail. But I got myself very personally involved. I was still a journalist at The Guardian at the time, and I set up the Mindfulness Initiative, which has clerked the All-Party Parliamentary Group in 2013 with Chris Cullen, the co-founder. Jamie has now taken over the Mindfulness Initiative. So I think what we have here is an opportunity to talk to you about some of the work we've been doing and presenting that to you. I'm very aware that all of us on the platform have a deep interest and commitment to the subject, so we're not claiming that this is somehow some sort of debate among in which you know you've got a range of different views. I think it's more an opportunity to present to you what we've been doing, and I very much hope and welcome your comments and questions. One of the things I would just say is that being involved myself in the process, I think we've had a very sort of reflective process, and this is something that I think will come up, that there are all kinds of things you can and can't say about mindfulness. You know, is it being instrumentalized? Is it a sellout? Is it a form of human enhancement? Is it Buddhism light? And we've had vigorous discussions about all of these, both in Parliament and with the parliamentarians and amongst the initiative, which is a group of about 18 volunteers and academics. So join the conversation with us. And, you know, we're really, really interested to hear your thoughts and your views on this. So let me just introduce you who's on the panel. Immediately to my left is Joe Cook. Joe is a medical anthropologist, senior lecturer at UCL, and Joe will explain her role in a minute, but I think it's been particularly interesting to have an academic in the process with us at all times, a critical friend, stirring up the discussion and provoking thought. Next is Chris Rowan. Now, Chris is really, really important to all of this. Chris was a Labour MP until the last election, has been a tireless advocate in Parliament and in the Welsh Assembly in particular for mindfulness, but in fact has extended his work to many other legislatures in Europe as well. Chris has been a great sort of engine. It was, as he will explain, largely due to him that the whole thing started in Parliament several years ago. And then on my far left is Jamie, who started volunteering for the Mindfulness Initiative nearly 2 years ago and has now taken it over and is the director. So Jamie can really talk to us about sort of where this initiative goes next and what's been happening, indeed, since we launched our report in October. But first of all, I'm going to ask Chris to explain a little bit about the background, this extraordinary, I believe, world pioneering initiative. John Kabat-Zinn has described it as a great sort of beacon to the world. So, Chris, if you could explain a little bit about how it ever got started.
Okay. So, my name is Chris Rowan. I was the Labour MP for the Vale of Clwyd in North Wales for 18 years. Prior to that, I was a primary school deputy head. I first came across meditation as a head or deputy head in 1987 when the school was being inspected. It benefited me and the rest of the staff, and I used it with my pupils, up to 39 kids in a class in those days. I came across mindfulness about 7 years ago when I was helping my daughter with her comparative religions. So I looked upon Buddhism and mindfulness and got to develop a practice. And then about 4 years ago, it be the change you want to see, I thought I should introduce this into Parliament. I approached Professor Lord Richard Layard. I knew he was an expert. He'd written Happiness, a New Science and The Good Childhood. So I approached him. I knew he'd be well connected. He brought in Mark Williams from Oxford, Professor Mark Williams, and also Chris Cullen. We had our first lessons about 3 years ago. Well, in fact, exactly 3 years ago. Since that time, 115, probably nearer now, 135 MPs and Lords have had mindfulness training. We have on a Tuesday night from 7:15 till about 8:45. It's an 8-week session. We have taken the religion and spirituality out of it in the first instance, introduced the science. There are no incense, there are no candles. We don't do mindful movements. We don't even lie down. And it's just sat in oak chairs in a select committee room practicing our personal practice. So, and then about 2 years ago, we decided to turn our personal practice into political practice on a cross-party basis and formed the All-Party Parliamentary Mindfulness Group. I was the Labour co-chair, Lorelei Burt was a Liberal co-chair, and Tracy Crouch was the Conservative co-chair. Of those 115 MPs, 50 of them were from the Parliamentary Labour Party, which amounted to about 20% of the Parliamentary Labour Party before the last election had mindfulness training. The mindfulness was mentioned in the Labour Party manifesto of 2015. I'm not saying that was the reason we didn't do too well. but it was mentioned in there, and I think that was a political first for the UK, if not the Western world. So we decided to have a report into four areas: the workplace, criminal justice, health and education. Mindfulness has already been accepted in 2004 by the National Health Service, by the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, for repeat episode depression. Its take-up has been minimal. So we had a breakthrough there. We hadn't maximised on that breakthrough. And so we had this inquiry, and we had about 8 or 9 sessions. It was evidence sessions: the workplace, mental health, criminal justice, mindfulness and physical health, education, workplace, policing and gangs. We wanted to include some diversity. So we have been blessed with Oxford University, Bangor University and Exeter University, who have provided support and have provided the science behind it. The Mindfulness Initiative is about 30-odd volunteers, no pay for these people. It's been done purely from the goodness of their heart. The gift that they have received from mindfulness, they want to spread to politics and other spheres of British life. Some of the questions I put down 170 questions in Parliament on mindfulness and 1,100 questions on societal and individual well-being. Some of the questions that were answered, the answers were shocking. There have been a 500% in the issuing of prescriptions for antidepressants between 1991 and 2011. A 500% increase. 90% of prisoners suffer with one or more psychological conditions. 32.3% of 15 to 25-year-olds have one or more psychiatric condition. That's when they're studying their GCSEs, their A-levels, their degree, their postgraduate degrees. They're studying at suboptimal levels, which is will affect their results, but more importantly, affect their outlook and who they are as individuals. So mindfulness, I think, can play a key part in helping individuals balance themselves and societies balance themselves. And when I was selling... Oh, no, sorry, we don't sell mindfulness. When I was offering the gift of mindfulness in the tea rooms of the House of Commons, I would not pitch it totally as a way to rebalance yourself. I pitched it for what it should be pitched as, which is about flourishing, about human, individual and societal flourishing. And I think that's why we've had such a big response. People don't judge it. And I think over the past 3 years, we have made progress. The way mindfulness is viewed is, you know, it's acceptable. It's a gentle way into mental health and well-being. So we had the launch on October the 22nd, was it, Madeline? And that was attended by three Conservative ministers: Tracy Crouch, the sports minister, Nicky Morgan, the Secretary of State for Education, and Alistair Burt, the minister responsible for mental health. That was absolutely fantastic. Nick Hurd, who used to be cabinet minister, was there for an hour. You know, he didn't just come in and go out. So we had senior representation, and all three ministers were positive about the role that mindfulness could play in developing governmental policy for British society. And the take-up has been fantastic, the recognition, and we've had media interest, we've had political interest from around the world. In September 2014, I spoke at the Dutch Parliament, 150 MPs, 30 of those have had mindfulness training in 6 months. I worked with a Conservative Assembly member, Darren Miller, to establish it in the National Assembly for Wales. 6 out of the 60 Assembly members have had mindfulness training. There has been interest from the European Union, from the French Parliament, German Parliament, Irish Parliament, Northern Irish Assembly, Canadian, Nova Scotian, Bermudian, Mexican City Parliament, and of course not forgetting the great work that Congressman Tim Ryan did in 2012, a year before we established ours, in establishing mindfulness on Capitol Hill. There is a huge... world turnover for profits for the pharmaceutical industry is something like $500 billion. They spend $19 billion a year on lobbying. If we can have an established network of mindfulness practitioners, legislators around the world, and we can spot good practice, we can spot good science, like we have in the NHS, like we hopefully will have after the £7 million grant to Oxford University to prove the science behind mindfulness in education. Started last year, 7 years' time, I believe we're going to be able to prove the science. Like it or not, the American government have been using mindfulness with the Marines in the US. Where the science is proven, where the best practice has been is successful, I think it's incumbent upon politicians to at least examine that best practice. And if we have this network, international network of legislators, I think that we would be doing the individual, society, and indeed the world a benefit. So we're just in the foothills now. I think great things will happen. And I want to thank Madeline, who set up the Mindfulness Initiative, and Jamie. That £19 billion, by the way, for the world pharmaceutical industry is matched on the mindfulness side by a part-time worker who's... a half-time worker who's got a quarter of a hot desk in a basement in Haggerston. So that's our sum total of our lobbying. And that's why I think it is important that mindfulness is integrated into politics for the betterment of British and world society.
Thank you very much. Jamie, I like the idea of the quarter of the hot desk.
Thank you very much, Chris. I mean, you touched on there how mindfulness has been encouraged by the National Institute of Clinical Excellence for the treatment of recurrent depression. There's also building evidence for a range of other healthcare applications. It's linked with improvements in kind of emotional intelligence metrics, compassion and empathy, and some cognitive skills also, and various types of resilience. And this sort of range of benefits can seem too good to be true, but the reason why it has such a diverse range of applications and benefits potentially is because we're talking about something fundamental to human experience, by which I mean awareness, knowing what we're doing when we're doing it. And one definition for mindfulness is paying attention on purpose, to the present moment, with the attitude of curiosity and care to things as they are. And perhaps the best way of seeing this is a natural human capacity that we all have. We have the capacity to be mindful, and whether we know it or not, some of us are more mindful than others, and that kind of natural variance is already associated with a range of benefits. So the more mindful among us tend to be better decision makers or more resilient to psychological distress. And we can choose to cultivate this if we wish. And there are different ways of cultivating it. Normally, it requires mindfulness meditation in a kind of 8-week face-to-face course. And rightly, there's debate around what the most appropriate way of cultivating it is, which populations it's appropriate for, and when. And we're just starting to figure out, really, what the most effective channels are, both sort of digitally and in face-to-face courses. But by paying attention initially to very sort of mundane, everyday bodily sensations, so the feeling right now of your feet on the floor, or the sensations of sitting in this chair, the feeling of the clothes on the skin or the air touching the skin. You might notice that as we pay attention to these everyday sensations or sounds around you, you can notice there's something settles in the mind, and maybe you can sort of feel it in the room. And we can bring attention to the bodily sensations in this way, but also the emotions, thoughts, the world around you, sort of sounds and sounds, sights, relationships. And it turns out that bringing your attention back in this way and cultivating certain qualities in that way of curiosity and care, we gradually get a handle on our own minds. And this has generated an enormous amount of public interest, I think largely because of word of mouth, because people are experiencing this for themselves and really getting the sense of wanting to share it, as you've heard, with a lot of passion from Chris. And so this inquiry certainly picked up on a lot of interest. There's the public profile and a large body of largely early evidence. So it's about two papers coming out every day, at least two papers now, perhaps the most researched area in psychology. But this is sort of largely pilot or evaluative studies. And this is not because of laziness on the part of scientists, but because it takes a lot of money to do really high-quality studies with large sample sizes and sort of rigorous control groups. And so that's one of our sort of main findings across the different policy areas that we looked at, that research now needs to be raised with high-quality randomised control trials so that we can confidently recommend that resources get allocated to widening access. But we also found that where there is good evidence, for instance, in the treatment of recurrent depression, that access is really patchy. And actually, it's probably those most well-off in society that are most able to access mindfulness, perhaps increasing health inequalities. So is there a role for public money to try and address that disparity? And the other kind of overreaching thing we found across different policy areas was the subject of teacher training and the importance of really knowing about mindfulness deeply in your own practice before you can share it with others. And so there is a lot of work underway to make sure that that it's not getting diluted or misunderstood in the way that it's being communicated and taught. So looking more specifically at the different policy areas that the inquiry addressed, health, education, criminal justice, and the workplace. In the health area, although mindfulness has been recommended since 2004, and using figures from the King's Fund report, Paying the Price, the Cost of Mental Health Care in England to 2026, we estimate that using mindfulness-based cognitive therapy to prevent relapse into depression could save £15 for every pound that is spent. And although 72% of GPs would like to send their patients to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy courses, only one in five know where to find it. And then this is really sort of geographically bunched. We think that only about 700 mindfulness teachers have the clinical training required to teach people with severe conditions like recurrent depression, and those who have got the training, most aren't really able to use it because of the priorities of the systems that they work in. So we think there's about an annual training capacity of 25,000 people. So 25,000 people at risk of recurrent depression could be taught mindfulness, and that's just 4.3% of the over half a million people who are at risk of relapsing into depression at great cost to themselves, to their families, and to society at large. So our report calls for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy to be included within the sort of revolutionary Improving Access to Psychological Therapies program, IAPT, over the next few years. Looking at long-term health conditions, depression is 2 to 3 times more common in people with long-term physical health problems than in the general population. And there are 15 million people living with long-term health conditions, and it accounts for 70% of all healthcare spending. And for people with both physical and mental health concerns, recovery is delayed for both. So where mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is as effective as antidepressants at keeping people well, we'd really like to see mindfulness provided in sort of physical health pathways for people who are living with conditions such as chronic pain, irritable bowel syndrome, and cancer, which we're calling upon NICE to review the evidence for because we feel it's got to that level of strength. jumping onto education, early evidence, which hopefully we'll be backed up by this large study that Chris mentioned, that mindfulness could help with well-being and the increasing sort of worsening state of mental health in schools, but also helping kids to sort of self-regulate, to resist impulses, to develop executive and emotional control, which some psychologists think is the single most important determinant of life outcome. And that seems to have an impact also on academic outcomes. So we'd like to see the Department for Education supporting a lot of grassroots interest within schools that's already there. In the workplace, there's probably the most... where there's been most interest so far and most publicity, but perhaps the area where research most needs to catch up with that enthusiasm. Having said that, there is sort of compelling reasons why we should be optimistic about mindfulness helping with a range of cognitive and performance outcomes as well as helping us to stay well. So we're calling for higher quality trials and for the government to take a lead as an employer, as the biggest employer in the UK, and to develop an understanding and best practice. And in criminal justice, similarly to education, their mindfulness seems to help with emotional regulation and executive control. And this is a population where 80% of offenders, according to one meta-analysis, have self-regulation difficulties. So they're struggling to resist urges and impulses, and that might be why they got into trouble in the first place. So the National Offender Management Service is also very interested in finding out whether mindfulness training could help with outcomes for that population. And also mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, it looks like it might be most helpful for those with a history of childhood abuse, which is much more likely for offenders to be the case. What we have here, we think, is a sort of considered and realistic set of recommendations for how we can develop our understanding of a sort of growing field and develop it in a sensible and sustainable way. Amongst the group of parliamentarians who make up the Mindfulness All-Party Parliamentary Group, there are also those that see there's something really kind of universal and fundamental about what one gets out of mindfulness practice, and they have a kind of quite a sort of a visionary ambition for where the group could go in its inquiry. And they sort of talk about Britain perhaps as a group of mindful nations and wonder what it might be like if it was the norm to train our hearts and minds to be more aware, to be more engaged, to be more open, resilient and empathetic. And perhaps by seeing our lives unfold in more detail, we can untap our sort of innate human ability to learn from moment-to-moment experience and develop as individuals and as a society in a kind of wiser and more sustainable way. Perhaps that's something I'm looking forward to inquiring with my colleagues and with parliamentarians moving forwards. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. And Joe, I just wondered if you could put this in some sort of broader context. Yeah. How do you understand? You've been doing a lot of research on mindfulness and your background is in meditation in Thailand, so you have a lot of expertise in this area. What are your sort of key insights, really, as to what the process has been about?
Key insights. Well, how extraordinary that we're here. I mean, how extraordinary that we're having this discussion and that mindfulness is being debated in Parliament, in Westminster. This is incredible. So maybe a generation ago, meditation was most closely associated, I think, with counterculture, baby boomer explorations. It was associated with forms of spiritual practice and was non-normal, I think. So now that when we had the inquiry process in Westminster, we'd begin each of the sessions with a mindfulness practice. So we're sitting in one of these beautiful wood-paneled rooms in Westminster, and we're asked to drop into our bodies and become aware of what's happening. And most of the time in my body, what was happening was, oh my God, this is so exciting. This is amazing. And I think for me as an anthropologist, working with the inquiry process over the last 2 years, the really interesting questions for me is how has meditation been adapted and evolved in ways that make it a seemingly very good fit to address challenges that are identified in civil society, and quite a range of challenges as well. You know, criminal recidivism and children's attention capacity or emotional regulation could be presented as very different societal challenges. So it's striking to me that meditation is being introduced as a pragmatic and targeted intervention in some cases, and in others is being understood in a much broader sense of human flourishing, this sense of well-being. You know, so what does that mean? What does it look like to flourish as a human being? That's not just about the prevention of depressive relapse. No, that's about something much more, something about our values or about the relationship that we have with ourselves that's not limited to that kind of measurable, targeted intervention. And for me as an anthropologist, that's fascinating. You know, so I find, and, you know, if we think about how has this happened? Right? How is it that a meditation technique that was developed in a monastic Buddhist context, you know, so mindfulness comes from the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, or the Greater Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Now, it was developed as a lay practice in the 1950s to the 1970s as part of the Burmese mass lay meditation movement. So until then, lay people hadn't really practiced meditation, certainly not in any great numbers at all. And it was about soteriological endeavor. It was about striving for release from rebirth. So very famous Thai monks will say that vipassana, or insight meditation, which is has mindfulness at its base, is the only way of getting enlightened. You know, now, that's a very different thing to teaching kids in school to practice for 5 minutes once a day in order to develop their emotional regulation or their attentional control or their exam results, improve their exam results. And I think there's one of the things that is striking to me is the relationship between Buddhism and science. So I think Buddhism, reformist Buddhism, has a very unique position in the pantheon of world religions, in that it is often understood to be quite uniquely compatible with scientific method. So you quite often hear about meditation or Buddhism being a form of internal science that's in some way in complement to empirical verification. So that's something you see a lot in the development of things like the Mind and Life Institute by the Dalai Lama, for example, this dialogue between contemplatives and scientists. So there's that side of it, this kind of this introduction, but I think there's also more than that. I think that in the UK and elsewhere, there's a growing trend in modern individualism, modern liberalism, to understand the self as a project, to see the self as something that can be worked on, the kind of the entrepreneur of the self, as it were. So you saw that with since the 1980s, if not earlier, you know, we've had these different waves of self-project making. So originally the fitness revolution, where suddenly we could take control of our bodies, we could shape them, we could hone them. And then we had the food revolution, where we could control, make ourselves better people by eating more quinoa or something like that. But what we see now, and I think this new frontier is something that we see not just in mindfulness but elsewhere, which is the mind as a site for that kind of work. No, so, I mean, it's been completely debunked now, but this idea that you could do a Sudoku every day and it would stop the early onset Alzheimer's or something, you know. There is a sense in which the mind has somehow become political. And I think that there are a few reasons for that. One has to be developments in neuroscience, which have been really kind of taken up in popular discourse, where we understand, we're able with brain imaging to almost see the mind at work. Right? But also with the development of the theories of neuroplasticity, there's a sense in which we can actually not just shape our minds, but somehow shape our brains. Now, I think any neuroscientist worth his salt would be very cautious about, you know, just what those images tell us and the extent to which neuroplasticity does actually impact on kind of our experiences of life. But it is striking that those discussions have become so ubiquitous and popular in the media, at the same time as this passion about mental health, you know. So that sense of the shaping of the self is then also combined in the UK with an increasing interest in preventative medicine. So mindfulness is, and this leads into this question of what human flourishing is. So mindfulness is being introduced as a way not just of addressing, for example, anxiety or depressive relapse, but creating one of the discourses around it is the discourse of resilience. You know, how do we create resilient children so that when the happenstance of life occurs, they have the emotional tools to deal with it? And I think that's something that In mental health care, but also in physical health, we see increasingly this idea that we can't control what happens to us, but we can control the way we engage with it. And so I think all of that combined has led to this situation where mindfulness is, I mean, it's everywhere. It's been really interesting doing this research for 2 years because it's been the kind of daunting keeping up with all of the information, you know. And I spent years working on meditation as a monastic practice, and I'd give academic papers and people would say, yes, it's intellectually very interesting, how exciting, great theory. And when I started giving papers about mindfulness in the UK, somebody would always come up to me afterwards and say, do you think it would help me? You know, there's a sense in which for all these academics who I'm engaging with, this is immediately relevant. Will this help my son? Will this help my husband? You know, there's an idea that this is about us rather than an abstract or theoretical or kind of othering ethnography.
Right. It would be great if any of you have comments or questions. Yeah.
Madeline, thank you. I'm Henry Ford. I have set up the RSA's mindfulness network. My question to the team here is that, as Chris said, we're in the foothills. And to get up to the hill station is going to take a lot of effort on individuals' behalf. In other words, developing a mindfulness practice I don't want to say it ain't easy, but it's, you know, to find 20 minutes a day or 40 minutes a day to do it, takes a lot of self impetus. That's if you understand what I'm saying. So how do you convert that curiosity about how can it help me into creating, a healthier and more mindful nation?
Hello there. My name is Joseph Heavey, and I'm just wondering how much mindfulness might become a kind of plaster for the ills and woes of society. Because if you look at depression, there's reasons for depression. If you look at anxiety, there's reasons for it. If you look at stress, there's reasons for it. So there's an external world as well, which is impacting upon people and causing lots of issues and lots of problems. You know, where is the place for mindfulness there?
Very good. And there was a lady there. Yeah, great.
Hi, my name's Alison Parry. I'm a total sceptic, and you haven't done a huge amount to change that. except Joe, because once you mentioned Burma, I understood that bit, that we should basically be sending all our school children for however many months it is to live with the monks. And that, I think, would be brilliant. I would go with that. But I can't see this as being anything different from the sort of my grandparents' 1950s England, where it was fresh air, greens, go to church on Sunday, that gives you your hour of contemplation, and facing things face on and deciding, you know, what had to be done, and doing it as a community. And I think you didn't mention that, but I think an awful lot of what mental problems is because people are not interacting with other people, and doctors have not got time for patients. They just give them medicines. So I don't know if you've got any way of stopping me from being about a 99.9% sceptic.
Well, it's terrific that you're here. If you're so sceptical, it's wonderful that you're here. I think you raise a number of very good points, particularly the one about community, and I'm sure that everybody will want to respond to that. But Jamie, do you want to answer some of those questions?
It's really tough to persuade people or sell mindfulness without just sort of giving it a go. I can talk about the evidence. We sort of touched on the kind of the neuroscience and that kind of thing. It's in the report, if you want to read the executive summary, at least. But I think someone described it as it's like trying to describe the taste of an orange to someone who hasn't ever come across oranges. If you're able to put your scepticism to one side for... if you could find an introductory session, that's probably the best way to decide for yourself whether there's anything in this or not. In terms of the evidence base, it's clear that people who are at risk of spiralling back into depression, once they've been depressed for three or more times, it cuts the rate of relapse by half, which is on par with antidepressants. And the evidence for other things like stress and anxiety is improving. The evidence base is there for that population, and we'll see. But the enthusiasm has largely been about people trying it themselves and then having to tell other people about it. It's not from people like me talking about the evidence, I don't think.
Henry's point: how do we? It's difficult to develop a practice. Absolutely, on a daily basis is. We're practicing Catholic. Give me the boy until the age of seven. I'll give you the man. I'll give you the child. I'll give you the adults. I think the earlier we start it, the better. Professor Mark Williams has got an interest in developing mindfulness for parents to be. So it strengthens the bond between the two parents, reduces maternal stress, a better family all around. It's been taught in Welsh primary schools and English primary schools to the age of seven. Pause B has been developed by Bangor University and Dot B by Oxford University and the Mindfulness in Schools project. So I think starting early is one of the key things. I think the next one was on the... Is it a sticking plaster? Now, that is a valid criticism. Is it the new opium of the masses? But I don't believe it is that. There are 7 billion people on the planet making individual decisions on an hour-by-hour basis. If you can help to rectify those individuals to make better, more informed, more in tune decisions, then that's 7 billion people who will be taking the world on a positive place. If you can get the politicians that represent those 7 billion people to make wise policy decisions, then all the better. There are tectonic things going on out there, whether it be the rise of individualism, consumerism, materialism, as Robert Putnam in his book Bowling Alone said, a decline in volunteering, commuting, computing, social media. There's whole masses of pressures that were not there for 30, 40, 50 or in the 1950s that are there now. And I think mindfulness can help us on an individual basis, not necessarily to get rid of those, but to treat it in a more balanced way. And I agree with the lady there about community. And I believe that if you and in connection with yourself, the most important relationship you can develop in your life is with yourself. And if that's a balanced relationship, then you're more likely to make balanced relationships with your family, with your community, with your society, with the planet, with the universe or whatever. So I think it all comes down to the individual. If you want a good community, you need a good community of individuals.
Just very, very briefly. I mean, I'm structurally in quite an interesting position here as the anthropologist of the process that we're discussing. So I'm not a purveyor of mindfulness, I guess, and it's not my job to convince anyone. I don't think. I also think there's a lot to be said for fresh air and long walks. Yeah, that sounds lovely. One thing I'd like to respond to, though, is the question about the question I understand behind your question is, does mindfulness lead to quietism? I suppose if is this the progressive kind of left critique, one of them is that it does nothing to address the injustices of an unjust world, and people might have very good reasons for being depressed or anxious and stressed. My experience, my ethnography suggests that that's just not the case. So I've been working, doing participant observation on mindfulness for about 3 years now, on mindfulness in the UK, and what you find is that the junior doctor, who's very close to burnout because he's faced with terrible working demands, is going to practice mindfulness because it gets him through his shift. He's also going to strike, and he's also going to make claims on the government for more equitable working conditions and a fairer pay, but he still has to get through what is a very, very stressful daily experience. So I don't think it needs to be either quietism or kind of a form of oppositional kind of political engagement. I don't see that those are either or, really.
Mary Wood, I'm chief executive of a charity dealing with obesity. And I have introduced, in fact, it's a 20-week program for weight management for severely obese people, in which we start with mindfulness practice. But I'm interested, first of all, in what you say about it. It is increasingly being used for physical as well as mental problems. And I'm wondering also whether you can comment on the fact that obviously, we can only introduce mindfulness to these people who have never heard of it, are total skeptics, eat their way through packets of biscuits every day to deal with their emotions. But this is just a tiny part of the program. So I'm also asking whether there's something which is so de minimis that it doesn't even count as mindfulness. Now, I hope not, because I hope that what I'm doing is actually, I think I have a very small amount of evidence that it is helping, but whether, first of all, if you can tell me anything more about research into physical health problems and mindfulness, and whether there is a de minimis where it really doesn't count.
Simon Turner. When Mathieu Ricard came, Madeleine, you were chairing that, he was asked a question of about mindfulness, and he said, well, a sniper can be mindful. Mindfulness without an element of something like compassion is a fairly fairly thin gruel. Now, it's interesting to hear Jamie's description of it, including curiosity and care. And I suppose my question is, where does the emphasis lie? Is it on the improvement of individuals, which is can be a collection of individuals, or is there an emphasis on the collective society? Is it an outward-looking thing, or predominantly an inward-looking thing? And where should society stand on that?
One more, and then we'll have finish off.
Alec Robertson Fellow. So Ken Robinson had a talk here some time ago, and he made a quote which created a laugh, and he said, no offence, because I was an academic. Academics, the purpose of an academic's head is to body is to carry their heads around between meetings. The question really is, can there be a downside to mindfulness? Because I am aware that I'm very mindful in many ways, and spontaneity and being conscious of the of other things is a good thing to have, and mindfulness might be detrimental to that. What do you feel about that?
Well, that's another very interesting comment, but that sort of seems to me to orientate around problems of definition. What exactly is mindfulness? It's a really interesting subject that we've given quite a bit of thought to, because, of course, there are lots of different definitions and lots of people are arguing that their definition is the right definition. But why doesn't Jamie have a crack at answering some of those?
Perhaps start with Matthew Ricard's definition, which I heard him use that when he visited London last also. And it isn't actually aligned with how a lot of other monastics would define mindfulness and how it's defined in the kind of Western cognitive science tradition and how Jon Kabat-Zinn defines it. We distinguish attention training from mindfulness, or in the kind of root language, where this is derived from, manasikara and sati, different constructs. So within the idea of mindfulness is this sense of care and kindness and acceptance, which is kind of almost like a spectrum there. So just training yourself to not be distracted and to be in the present moment in order to shoot someone would be attention training, but the kind of open curiousness and curiosity and care would be mindfulness. So I'd love to have the opportunity to chat that through with Matthew, but for the sake of our definition, we would definitely say that good, high-quality teacher training requires a good understanding of the difference there, and to embody those compassionate attitudes when you're training it, or for it even to be explicit within the training. And increasingly, that is the case. It's more and more explicit. There are both relational practices, so sort of speaking and listening with mindfulness in order to bring it out into the world, to address that part of your question, but particularly having practices that really cultivate that side of mindfulness to distinguish it. And in terms of whether mindfulness might make you less, spontaneous, really, really interesting one. It's similar to the, you know, is mindfulness anti-thought? Will it stop us mind-wandering or being creative or being spontaneous? And the answer is no. I think that there can be times where, when you're training in mindfulness, and you're really practicing it in the kind of early days, maybe it could get in the way of being spontaneous. But you can be sort of open and mindful of your kind of impulses and choose to allow them to happen. And you can also go off on sort of flights of creativity whilst being sort of tethered to the present moment and to your body and to but allowing yourself to go off on that. So it kind of isn't anti-thought and it isn't anti-spontaneity. But there might be points in practice, when you're first getting used to it, that it might feel a little bit clunky or something.
So, right. We're running out of time. I've been asked to wrap by 2. I just wondered if we could come for final comments, and it looks like Jamie's got to make one.
One very last thing, and that's with the long-term health conditions. There's something quite interesting about it being a mind-body practice. And we're starting to see more widely in healthcare that the mind is attached to the body and doesn't just take us from meeting to meeting. And so that's perhaps why... but let's chat afterwards, perhaps, about the evidence base.
Chris, do you have last comment?
On the issue of mind-body, I think René Descartes, in the philosophy, said that they were separate. I'm also chair of the heart group, all-party heart group in Parliament, which I set up for 14 years ago, and the mind group. And I believe the two are connected, and I'd like to see them more connected. But on the issue, I think it was it Mike that said, could it be harmful? One of the things that we have got to watch is to ensure that with the interest in mindfulness and the more people being trained on it, that we don't train people too quickly. It takes, I'm not sure, 3, 4, 5, 10 years to get a deep mindfulness practice. We haven't got to dilute the quality with the quantity. And I think if people are properly trained, and when people apply to go on a CERT course, they are properly screened to see what their conditions are, then there's less likelihood of any damage being done to the individual. And I think Simon mentioned, or was it Mike again, are we outward-looking or inward-looking?
And I think with loving-kindness practices, where you concentrate on yourself and then somebody you like and somebody you're indifferent to and somebody you dislike, you know, you're training your mind to look inwardly and outwardly at the same time. So it's not either or, it's both.
Great. And very briefly.
So I'm an academic. I love this line. But I'm an academic, and I do have based all of my research on looking at a practice or different kinds of practice. And it just strikes me that, and I've always maintained that if you're going to do research about meditation, it's helpful to do some meditation. You know, without my research being about what happens when Joe meditates. You know, it's not solipsistic hubris. It's about finding ways to understand the assertions that people are making in a particular context. But I'm struck actually about what this distinction between the mind and body can contribute to our understanding of mindfulness. And I think whenever we have a kind of a binary like that, it's always worth saying, you know, you can use Ben Goldacre's thing of, I think you'll find it's more complicated than that. And then we can create really interesting research questions to explore.
Well, thank you very much for your questions and comments. It's very interesting to hear some of the scepticism and some of the enthusiasm. To have it all in the room is fantastic. And many thanks to everybody for their comments on the panel. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.